This is Fully Vested, a weekly podcast where Jason Rowley and Graham Peck discuss technology and venture capital investing. This week, we discuss the Q4 end of year 2019 global VC report from Crunchbase, written by Jason and his team. The show was recorded on January 12th. You can learn more at fullyvested.co.
So how's your weekend been?
Oh, it's been good. It's been pretty low key, which is two low key weekends in a row for me, which is nice. It's probably been months since I've had two low key weekends in a row.
Nice. Yeah.
How about you?
I've also had kind of a pretty nice low key weekend. I had some volunteer work that I was finishing up. I had, let's see what else I was doing. Yesterday,
you probably needed that after writing what we're about to talk about.
Oh
right?
Yeah. Oh no. Oh Graham, as you know, as always, my as always, a lot of my life is a slow motion train wreck, and this past week was no exception. But it was really good yesterday to. I think yesterday, most of the day, I spent sort of just like sacked out on a couch. What did I watch last night? I watched one of the newer Star Wars movies.
Which one was it? Was it
The Force Awakens, the first one of this, you know, three movie trilogy that just concluded?
The trilogy of trilogies.
Yeah. The trilogy of trilogies. And I watched The Force Awakens, and it was a Star Wars film. It was, I did not grow up like super duper like into Star Wars or into Star Trek or like into comic books or whatever. Or not comic books, but sort of like more broadly like superhero type stuff. And so, you know, I have like a somewhat more far removed, you know, relationship with these particular media properties, but I do like a good Star Wars movie. You know, it's sort of like, it's like comfort food entertainment, which is great.
Yeah. I mean, you certainly know what you're getting, right?
Yeah, exactly. You're getting, I mean, at least
some great special effects and a story that ostensibly is about good versus evil.
Yeah, exactly. So it's that sort of good stuff.
Nice.
Yeah. Yeah. Hang on one sec. Let me just take a sip of this. Not a sponsor, but there's this great little Michigan tea company called Fraser Tea that I've been drinking a lot of lately. And I have their, what is it called? It's like a white tea blend. It's called like the fruity bubble gum or whatever, something or whatever.
Ooh, I'm gonna have to check this out,
dude.
Hey, I really actually had nothing fancy, but I had a drink I was going to get during the show, and I forgot in my prep. Hold on one second.
All right. Well, this is the show.
Oh, well, this is the show. Well, everybody, right. Jason can Jason can riff for a few seconds.
Oh no. Hey friends, this is Jason. I'm really bad at filling time, except for when I have to talk, in which case I'm really good at filling time. But I'm feeling very bad at filling time right now. So I'm just staring at Graham's... See, Graham and I, we Skype when we do this. And I'm staring at his wall. And he's not giving me a lot of material to work with. Oh, and the man himself, he returns.
Oh, and I had to unmute my mic.
Hey!
Hello. Okay.
Hey, how are you doing, man?
Oh, I'm doing good. So I went with the San Pellegrino Blood Orange. That's my favorite flavor, San Pellegrino's.
Nice. You know what? The thing I've realized that I need to engineer, and we're going to get into the, oh man, all of I was about to say our readers, our listeners who have aversion to people like with like food and drink. You know what? This is our like listener qualification process, right? Like if you don't,
I think we said that in one of the very earliest episodes.
Yeah, exactly. If they don't like us at our best, they'll hate us at our worst.
That's right. That's right. If you don't want to listen to 2 to 8 minutes of us being idiots, then you're definitely not going to listen to us pretending to be smart. I don't know.
Graham, we should probably get this show on the road.
Well, and I'm super excited, as yeah, I always too. Am. You know, I mean, once every quarter, we get the great opportunity to review the industry that you write about and I work in, every day.
Yeah.
We get to talk about at least once a quarter, kind of some of the benchmarks of it. And obviously, you did a great job. You and your team did a great job reviewing it yet again. And I really liked how you did some things that kind of were end of year and even a couple of notes throughout of kind of end of decade or whole decade kind of in review type of stuff.
Oh, thank you.
Even though you also said at one point, like specifically, this is not a decade in review. It's a quarter or year in most cases. But seeing big numbers like $1.5 trillion invested in venture that Crunchbase tracked over the last decade is like, wow, that's pretty cool to see.
It's a bunch of money. It's a lot of money.
a lot of the dollars.
Yeah. Not all the dollars, just most of them, many of them.
Oh, just
several of the dollars.
Just a lot of the dollars.
Okay. Cool.
So,
yes.
So Jason, I guess, just to dive in and get started, and of course, folks, we'll in our show notes, we'll include the link to Jason and his team's hard work. Jason, I guess just to start out at a high level, where do you think we sit at the end of 2019 in the kind of state of global venture?
Just as the very squeaky L train comes through the background. So 2019 has sort of been a very interesting year for a number of different reasons. One, this was sort of when using that sort of example of like Schrodinger's cat, which I'm probably going to butcher here. Please don't at me. I'm not a physicist, but like, the idea of like, okay, so you have this cat that gets put in a box and there's, some sort of a little radioactive element in there that may or may not emit a particular, particle as the result of its decay. And that particle may or may not hit a vial that may or may not like leak gas into the box and kill the cat. But there's like a somewhat equal chance that this doesn't kill the cat. Anyways, this is all to say that 2019 gave private and public market investors an opportunity to open the box and look at the cat. And a lot of the cats that a lot of investors have sort of like fed along these days, or up until this point, we open the box, they hit public markets, and a lot of them turned out to be, pretty disappointing, at least from the perspective of their initial debut, or in the case of WeWork, which I swear to God that I hope this is like the last time I mention WeWork during this whole conversation. They're non-IPO, right? But like Uber went public and it is materially lower than its IPO price. Lyft went public and it was materially lower than its IPO price. A lot of Slack went, public and it's materially lower than its IPO price. There's so many of these companies have gone public and have not lived up to their last sort of private market valuation. But like that's sort of largely limited to, that's a very US-centric approach. Sort of here's where I see, the venture market like right now at like a global scale, right? And again, this is only based off of like Crunchbase's projections and sort of my own sort of pontificating here. So please take absolutely everything I say with a grain of salt. But in general, it feels like 2019 was sort of like it just feels like we're really, really late in the cycle, man. Like, I have no idea what is going to happen in 2020, 2021, 2022, but I have a very strong hunch, not even a belief. I don't even want this to be true, but I do have a strong hunch that like the next few years are probably not going to be quite as rich as they have been in the past. And I'm not saying that just because of, some new geopolitical instability or some, material change in the broader macro economy. But just because like there's only so many really gigantic companies that get founded, in every sort of cohort. And a lot of the ones that needed to raise, you know, a large amount of money have. And those that and those that did sort of went public and didn't really have a great outcome. So I don't know. I mean, it feels like we're really late in a cycle. I don't think that there's any particular reason to, you know, like be extremely scared. But I do think that, like, I don't want to say that the good times are behind us, but like we will probably look back to 2018 and 2019 as incredibly good years, in the near future. And it might be a really long time until we see these sorts of, you know, numbers put up again on an annualized basis.
Yeah, I think that that makes a lot of sense. And I mean, I think buoyed by probably the amount of cash and capital that's just flowed at such low interest rates, which you touch on briefly, you know, into companies is probably, of course, one of the big drivers of that. I mean, I guess I hope that we've got another little while in the, in the market cycle, of course. Got some big plans personally, as well as, you know, our team having bigger plans for things that we want to accomplish, of course, and capital will be helpful for those. Of course, I'm talking about the my team at Cultivation, but yeah, I definitely get that point. And it's interesting, you know, digging in on one of the things that you touched on. It's interesting that the companies that have that many, not all obviously, but many of the companies that have gone public, as you mentioned, kind of out of this most recent venture funded cohort, have done so poorly. Or again, in the case of WeWork, actually pulled their IPO efforts after formally announcing that they were making them. So, you know, it's I guess that's just interesting. And I hope that either companies yet to go public or companies yet even to be created will be successful at being some of the next, the next giants, right? I mean, looking back to kind of, I guess, the last cohort before the, you know, financial crisis of 2008 through 10, you got a lot of big companies like Google and Facebook and things like that out of that time period who are now public and profitable and very successful. And obviously those are big tech successes. Certainly there are things like Zoom that we can point to, which I hope and think is still above its, above its IPO price. But as you hit on some key big companies that that aren't. You know, and we talked about in our last episode, I think, or one of our last two episodes, using capital as a moat. And I think that that's a strategy that a lot of big companies have done. And we, again, talked about that in great detail in our last episode, but that has happened in the venture funding ecosystem and hasn't gone successfully.
Yeah,
and some of the ones you pointed out that are substantially below their IPO prices are some of the exact companies that tried to use capital as a moat and were not successful in doing so.
Yeah, so there's some really interesting sort of like trends that are happening in the background that I think are definitely worth noting. So at least as of most recently, like. So dollar volume in 2009, let's just sort of like go over some top line numbers here, right? Okay. So like dollar volume in all of 2019 is projected to be somewhere around $294.8. So $295 billion plus or minus. That number may change over time as new data gets added to Crunchbase or as, you know, rounds that may have been more accurately sort of labeled as, say, I don't know, like a big corporate investment round. Things might get recategorized slightly, but let's just use that like $295 billion number for reference. That's down from a projected $322 billion in 2018 worldwide. Now, even though dollar volume is down, it's largely attributable to the fact that there's just been both fewer of these sort of like super giant deals, and super giant deals, it's a term of art that I coined and we coined over at Crunchbase News to describe, you know, individual venture capital deals of $100 million or more, right? Huge amounts of money. Companies raising in single rounds of funding what you used to have to go to, like, public markets to raise in an IPO, or, like, by comparison, like, in one round of funding, a company is raising what, for example, a smaller, you know, venture capital firm might raise for the entirety of a new fund. So a lot of money, but there's fewer of these super giant deals happening now. And there are fewer of those, like, super crazy outlier rounds, even in this, like, totally rarefied, you know, class of super giant deals. There aren't as many, like, I don't know, $500 million or billion-dollar funding deals happening in 2019 as there were in 2018. So dollar volume might be down, but deal volume is up, you know, year on year. There's projected to be just shy of, like, 32,800 deals struck in 2019 versus approximately 32,900 deals struck in 2018. The precise numbers are listed in the report. And so I do, even though there has been declines in dollar volume, the deal volume gains, to me at least, are really heartening, because a lot of those gains happen at seed stage, like angel and seed stage rounds. You know, I don't think that I think that the next few years are going to be really interesting. And there's certainly going to be a lot of companies in that sort of, like, pipeline for raising Series A's and Series B's and stuff going forward. But, like, I think if you're just looking at the top line numbers of, you know, like, all dollar volume or whatever, 2018 is certainly looking like the peak. 2019, you know, might be the start of a slight retreat from those highs.
I think that that's a really interesting point. Hopefully that, you know, that makes funds like the one I work for and others, you know, well stocked with upcoming classes or cohorts, as you call them, of great startups to invest in. You know, this may be a little bit of an aside from the, you know, from the global trends kind of review, but are there any subsectors or specific areas that are catching your attention as being more, more interesting to watch right now? I'm sure the answer is yes, but I guess what are those kind of sub pockets that you find particularly interesting right now?
None that I reviewed in particular for this precise report, you know, that we're talking about right now. And I was not the only person. I did all the data analysis and visualization for this report and for our North America report, although Joanna wrote that. And we have reports about Texas and a check-in on the state of Europe coming out next week as well. We didn't really look at any sectors in particular. Unfortunately, I'm just going to have to sort of, like, pull out of my backside, you know, what I've been hearing a lot on, you know, on Twitter and reading in the news and on all the little blogs on Medium and stuff, is, you know, people are really, they continue to be really, really excited about, you know, software as a service, you know, focused on businesses.
We cut our episode here to make a special around 21-minute episode. If you want to learn more about what Jason and Graham think are trends of what sectors to watch in venture funding, check out our special episode.
So the other thing that I think is really interesting to note is that over time, you know, we've started to see a lot more, you know, venture deal activity take place outside of, you know, the United States and Canada. And that is really interesting. It's really interesting to see the rest of the world sort of, like, pick up, you know, their own venture ecosystem sort of, like, pick up. But, you know, dollar volume still remains relatively concentrated in the U.S. and Canada, but that is changing too. So I think, you know, the other thing that investors, or really anybody who's listening to this, you know, if you're just a person who wants a job at a startup, like and you're outside of like a major market, like if you're not in the United States or Canada, or if you're, you know, not in, if you're in the United States and Canada, but not based in, you know, a major tech hub like, you know, the San Francisco Bay Area or New York or Boston or whatever, I think that the notion of more venture activity, more startup activity, more startup funding happening everywhere is and accelerating faster, you know, outside of, you know, major tech hubs. I think that is a an incredibly heartening sign as well.
And do you think that it will continue kind of the, I think what you've historically called the balance of power between North America and the rest of the world? I mean, obviously, there's some comments about that in here, and I'm not expecting you to make any hugely forward-looking statements or anything, yeah. But it looks like maybe the U.S. and Canada have kind of remained, at least on a deal volume basis, around that 39% for the last three quarters and been within a percent or two of that for now five quarters in a row. So is that a trend that you expect to continue moving forward? I mean, I know that one of the dynamics we've talked about a lot before and you specifically call out in here is, you know, a decline in Chinese startup fundraising. So it seems like, you know, even though that is occurring, the rest of the world is kind of picking up that slack. You know, all in all, where do you see that going moving forward, to the extent you have any early thoughts on what will be the case next quarter?
Yeah. So it's really hard to make, make any sort of prediction, because everything, you know, anything can happen, right? But if I was a betting person, which in this capacity I'm not, it's hard to say anything about like one quarter from now, but so I'd be more prepared to actually sort of make a statement about like a year or two or three from now, right? So, which is like, assuming that things sort of continue on their current trajectory, I would not be surprised to see that at some point in, you know, in the next couple of years, that even that the United States's and that the US and Canada's relative share of deal volume and dollar volume is likely to go down. I'm not going to make any predictions about whether or not dollar volume and deal volume in general for the whole world are going to go up or down. But I think that regardless of what happens in that capacity, you know, the United States and Canada are going to account for a smaller chunk of that, relatively speaking. I'm not saying that U.S. and Canadian dollar volume or deal volume is going up or down, but I think that over time, you know, we've sort of successfully seen the export of the United States venture, the U.S. sort of originated venture capital model, you know, overseas, and there's, you know, a lot of markets that are sort of expected to grow incredibly quickly over the next, you know, 3 years, 5 years, 10 years, that I think it would be foolish to make to say that at least from a proportional basis, that the U.S. and Canada is going to be in a significantly stronger position than it is relative to the rest of the world going forward. I think we're just sort of starting to see the rise of, quote unquote, the rise of the rest, which, you know, is very interesting.
You know, one of the things that I thought was interesting, and kind of on a related note, you talk about some of the most active lead investors. And I think of the chart that says 2019's most active lead investors in early and late stage rounds globally. One of the things that I saw that was interesting and that was, of course, called out is that Sequoia, under its kind of inclusive of its franchise operations in China and India, represents three of the top 10 most active global investors. And if those those three entities, the three different sequoias, that of China, India, and Sequoia as a whole, were put together, they would be by far and away the most active of all, coming in at nearly 100 deals, being nearly twice Tiger Global Management and Tencent, which are the next two most active. So
yeah, there's a chance that, I mean, we'd have to deduplicate the list because it's possible that, you know, deals may have been co-listed for Sequoia Capital and Sequoia Capital China as an example. But yeah, in general, Sequoia Capital is the most active investor when it comes to leading early and late stage rounds in Crunchbase's data set at the time that we queried it. Yeah.
And that's one of the charts that's based on real-time data, not any type of projection. Right,
right. Because, and these are numbers that will change over time as additional historical funding data gets added to Crunchbase. Really important to say, to specify that.
Right, of course. So one of the other things that I think is interesting in kind of the next point in the article was about, you know, raising of funds and sticking with the theme of Sequoia. Obviously, they've had some big news, but there have obviously been a ton of other, a ton of other funds that have announced substantial capital raises and success lately. I mean, is there anything, do you track volume of funds announced in any way? I mean, obviously, that's not one of the data points that's included here, but is fundraising in the venture world by funds and commitments from their LPs? Do you see any trajectory of where that's going?
So yeah, you're right in saying that we don't have that we don't report those numbers in this particular report. I mean, Crunchbase, for its part, and for the record, anybody who's listening, Crunchbase is my employer, but not a sponsor of the show. And I'm speaking here as independently and not in my capacity as a employee of Crunchbase. But Crunchbase does have a data set of the funds that firms raise. And it's relatively, I mean, it's like, as far as data quality goes, it's all right. And directionally, we've done some like directional analysis in the past, and you know, it comes so there's a few different things to keep in mind, right? Like when it comes to this whole like balance of power discussion, which I think is a very fun way to like frame things, like still the balance of power lies in favor of firms that are capable of raising like 9 and 10 figure, you know, VC funds, right? They are the ones that raise the lion's share of all the capital that gets deployed by limited partners into venture capital, which in turn venture capitalists invest in startups. But there's been a tremendous explosion over the past, you know, couple of years in fundraising around these sort of like micro venture firms, primarily focused at like, you know, pre-seed and seed. And there's just been this enormous explosion of those. I think I read recently that there's now, it's something like, what was it? It was like 1,000 like micro and nano VC firms are operating today. And that to me is really interesting. Although, given the fact that they are raising such small funds, I'm wondering what their long-term financial wherewithal is to continue backing the companies that they've, you know, sort of put, you know, put some money behind right now.
Yeah, I mean, and obviously that changes the game a lot. I mean, not to get lost on that point, but obviously the size and stage that you come in at, and then the way you defend that position, if at all, moving forward, is a huge factor in the way that you potentially garner returns as a VC. That is an interesting trend, and I didn't know that the number was that high. I know a number of people who've raised smaller funds, like in the sub $10 million range. I don't know what what the more formal definition of a micro or nano VC would be, but I definitely know a bunch of people who have raised sub $10 million venture funds and then are working through whatever their exact thesis is to invest those. I think for the most part, many of those people end up not defending their percentage past a check or two into those companies because they quite simply don't have enough dry powder to do so. I think many early VCs raise a small first fund with the expectation that if they make some successful investments that they gain some traction and following from investors or more institutional type investors and then hope they can raise a larger fund and maybe even buy some of their follow-on pro rata in some of those companies that were in that first fund. I've definitely seen that as a kind of MO of some early small fund operators.
Yeah.
Although I won't speculate that that's what all 1,000 micro and nano VC guys are doing.
Maybe it's not 1,000. I'm trying to see, Graham, I'm trying to do some real-time fact-checking here about my own statements. And I will tell you, can you allow me one moment of flexing and complaining?
Absolutely.
Graham and our listeners, listeners, you don't have a choice. I'm just going to complain and you're coming along for the ride. which is that. Which is that when you write a lot of stuff about one particular sector and you want to go fact check yourself, you end up I don't mean to, pick on or support Google on this, but it can be Google, DuckDuckGo, Bing, doesn't really matter. But like, if I just did a Google for, number of VC, micro and nano VC funds in the market today, what sucks is that the top 6 or 7 results are all to my articles. So I'm having a really hard time fact checking myself.
You should write less, Jason.
I really have to. That's the goal. That's the goal, Graham. Long term is write less and search more, I guess. Anyways, but whatever the number is, it's a bunch of new investors coming in. But that continues the question, right? You have this explosion in investment dollars and interest at pre-seed, seed, angel stage sort of stuff. But the question is cool. If you're a $10 million, pre-seed fund, are you going to be the firm that people come to when they go out and raise their, $3 or $4 million seed check? I don't know. Do you have the capital to invest in it? Good question. There might be a lot of really, really smart people, or people who think that they're smart, going into seed stage investing right now. But maybe we'll start to see that sort of reemergence of like a Series A and Series B crunch, right? There's been so much funding going in at early stage, but are all of these, what percent, is there going to be a greater percentage of companies, that come out of this and graduate to Series A and Series B? I don't know. There's a lot of weird internal dynamics in the fundraising side from that sort of GP side of the table. I will give one final anecdote on that point, unless you have more follow up, which is that a friend of mine works at one of the large, they might take issue with me calling them a friend, an associate, a colleague, a chum, somebody I know, works at one of the big law firms that deals in new venture fund formation. And they've said that at least on their sort of like in this small dollar sort of, asset class, that they've just been completely overwhelmed and that there's, a waiting list for people to go through the setup process on new venture funds, new first time venture funds in particular. I don't know. This also gets into the whole question of, are these folks going to have enough success to go raise a fund too?
Yeah. Yeah. I wonder.
I don't know. I mean, there's so many, if it feels like, so audience, if it feels like there's like that this whole conversation is going in a lot of different directions, it's because it is. And it's because there's so much uncertainty around these like super, super big, you know, topics in the venture economy right now.
Well, right. And I mean, obviously, there's a story behind every single one of the deals, right? And what was the total deal volume? You know, 32,000 or something like that, you know, over a year.
Yeah, something like that.
You know, I mean, yeah, I mean, obviously, every deal has its story. And each one of those deals probably in most cases has a number of participants. One of the things you don't mention in here, but maybe you have some insight in, do you know the average number of investors per deal round?
Ooh, like over, like to see that over time?
Yeah. Well, or even just a single data point, like of the 32,000 some odd.
Oh, like how many unique investors that happened were involved last there? Year?
Yeah, yeah. The average deal had 4.2 investors in it, or something like that.
No, I don't have that number off the top of my head. I could take time to derive it, and that's actually a really good idea for an article. I will have that duly noted. And who knows, we might have this as a follow-up topic on Fully Vested Friends.
As long as I get a co-writing credit on that one, or a co-ideating credit.
Yeah, you'll get a hat tip at the bottom. Yeah, hat tip to Graham Peck for, anyways. So no, I don't have that number in front of me right now, but it would be very interesting to see, and I'd be willing to bet that... And I don't know whether this would actually bear itself out in the data set that I have access to, but I'm willing to bet that in general, the trend has been toward having more investors involved in any particular deal, particularly at seed and early stage, right? Because there's just so many more investors trying to vie for allocation in what's still ultimately a relatively limited pool of viable deal flow.
And those size deals on average are increasing in size. I think both the median and mean deal size at the earliest stages have gone up. While right. That's not necessarily true through some later stage deals, that is true at the earliest stages, that both mean and median deal size are increasing in a notable way.
Right, which means... For our slightly less, you know, for anybody here who might be less familiar or less comfortable with statistics, when we talk about the mean, we're talking about an average, and that's just like sum everything up and you divide it by however many, you know, samples by your sample size. And then the median is the midpoint of any sort of distribution. And so if you see an average, you know, of a population going up, you know, pretty significantly over time, but you see the median remaining relatively flat. There's a lot of different reasons why that could be the case, but a very common reason is because there might simply just be more really big outlier, you know, instances, right? In this case, we're sampling funding rounds. But if you start to see the median also shift up over time, that's an indication that these are changes that are happening at a sort of broader population scale sort of frame. And so, yes, to see, you know, median deal size go up at seed stage over time is really, really interesting and maybe scary, depending on your framing there. Same stuff happening at early stage too. But yeah, so on average, yeah, deals are getting bigger.
And some of the numbers are that the median had been between 400,000 and 600,000 for the last four quarters.
Yep.
For seed and angel round size, and that number jumped to 1 million. The median did in Q4 2019, and the same kind of thing was true for the average. So again, there obviously are outliers since the average is above the median, but the average had been between 1.1 and 1.4 million in the prior four quarters, and that number jumped up to 1.8 million in Q4 2019. So obviously both of those numbers being up substantially, the median almost twice as high as it had been just one quarter earlier, is certainly interesting to look at, that companies are getting more dry powder, more funding at their earliest rounds.
Right. And that's not just a U.S.
And there's more deal size or more deal flow, more funded deals by deal count
right.
at that stage too, or right. those stages.
Right. And it's important to note that this growth in deal size is not limited only to, you know, like what's happening in the United States and Canada. Like, if you look at, and this is numbers that were not published in our report, but I have because we have all the aggregated numbers here. Like the Q4 2018, you know, median deal angel and seed stage deal size in internationally. And so that's all markets outside the United States and Canada taken together. You know, that that median was for seed stage $500,000. And it rose to at the end of Q4 2019, you know, $0.8 million or $800,000. And so, yeah, like, in other words, there's been growth at a very, very rapid clip, both in the U.S. and Canadian market, but also the rest of the world as well.
Anything specific you want to call out in, we've talked a lot about seed stage stuff, anything you want to call in like early or later stage deals?
Nothing really in particular in early stage, which in our sort of terminology is Series A and Series B rounds, plus a subset of other types of rounds within a certain dollar range, typically between $5 and $15 million, for stuff like, you know, convertible notes and other things that aren't labeled Series A and Series B. There isn't really much that's too exciting that's happening there, which actually might be worth noting, which is that really over time, total deal in dollar, so like relative to the same time last year, like Q4 2018, the projections indicate that, you know, deal volume is down almost, you know, it's down 4.7% from Q4 2018. And dollar volume is up only slightly, well, maybe a little bit more than slightly, 12.8% relative to Q4 2018. But that's really only attributable to the fact that, you know, deal sizes have been getting larger, right? Not to the fact that there's been any more, you know, early stage companies funded. So that's an earlier, to our earlier point, and why the lack of growth that's happening at early stage is highly germane to this explosion at seed stage, which is that, you know, one would expect to see, oh, wow, there's this giant wave of seed stage companies getting funded today. Hopefully that means that sometime year, two, three, you know, down the road, those companies will start raising more and more early stage rounds, right? Well, we've seen an uptick in seed stage rounds over time, but we haven't seen necessarily that same commensurate uptick in early stage, you know, yet. And maybe,
actually the opposite right now.
Right.
You know, I mean,
contraction
to only the tune of about 5%, but actually a slight reduction now.
But the fact that we're talking about, a 4.5% decline in early stage deal volume, while simultaneously we're talking about a 10.5% gain in angel and seed stage deal volume, there's a disconnect there.
And record high deal volume in total, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Primarily spurred on by ridiculously.
By that 10% increase.
Yeah, exactly. This is one of those questions is as these companies move, you know, sort of further downstream, you know, like, are they going to be as successful in raising, you know, seed and a Series A and Series B rounds? I don't know. And that's a big, that's one of those big questions there. As far as like late stage stuff goes, unless you had a follow-up question at early stage.
Nope.
You know, I think that the real story there is just that, it's all about the story of supergiant rounds and how there's slightly fewer of them now. You know, there aren't as many sort of, you don't see as many news stories about like, oh, such and such company with wide name recognition goes out and raises, you know, $1 billion. Like, that just doesn't really happen quite as much anymore. It's more common for companies, you know, if they're going to go raise like a really big round, like, you know, you still do see a lot of news about like, oh, $100 million here, $200 million here. But it's not like the crazy level that it was in 2018. And I think a lot of that has to do with people sort of taking a more measured look at the financials of the companies that they're trying to invest in, the long-term sort of, you know, viability and market size and opportunity that these companies are trying to look at. And then also, you know, actually, I don't think I had a third point. I was just going to come up with some sort of BS there, but you know what I mean? it feels as though, you know, really everywhere except for seed stage, it feels like the wind has somewhat gone out of the sails a teeny tiny bit. And that's mostly because many of the most, you know, cash hungry businesses that we've seen in recent history, they've since graduated to raising from public markets.
Moment of personal privilege. I will say congratulations to all of my colleagues on our team at Cultivation Capital, which in the similar kind of counterpart to the worldwide report that Jason and I are talking about, but that is more specifically focused on North America, we were listed as one of the most active lead investors at the early stage, having done 5 deals that fit their search criteria there. So congratulations to all of my colleagues in a moment of personal privilege to be able to say that. So and thank you to your colleagues, Jason, for that call out.
Well, it's just some numbers, Graham. Congratulations. You showed up 5 times. You have 5 rows in the data set for that particular period
for that sort of, for that search query.
Yeah. No, actually doing that, I mean, I can, Graham, I'll walk through the data analysis offline. There's nothing very exciting. It's just some merges and joins and group buys. Like, it's not very exciting.
I think that you're, I think you're minimizing the importance that you bring to the data analysis and how seriously you take it.
Graham, I just make pivot tables for a living.
I've seen how Jason works, folks, and it's truly a thing to behold.
No, it's really not. It's a guy staring at a computer and swearing at charts.
I've actually watched as he wrote a substantial portion and generated almost all the charts of one of these. And that is actually about how it goes. I don't know what I expected, but I don't know. I thought there'd be all kinds of fanfare, and it's really Jason and a couple of screens, and he's sitting there looking at them for a long time. And that's kind of how it
goes. What's that phrase? Tilting at windmills, staring at screens?
So maybe just to spend the last few minutes as we wrap up talking about the money outside of things. I know in your kind of early comments, you mentioned some things about some of the unsuccessful IPOs or even pulled IPOs. But, you know, just from a money out perspective, which is obviously much shorter in your report than the money in section and has, kind of a lot fewer charts and a lot less, I wouldn't say detail, but...
No, you can fairly say it has less detail.
Okay, that has a lot less detail. You know, and then any conclusions, I guess, you know, the big thing that stuck out to me was, you know, obviously the two kind of traditional ways that VCs unlock value for themselves and the LPs that they represent is obviously by companies going through M&A activity and or some sort of IPO or public listing. And while you make some really great points about direct listings becoming more trendy as another way to achieve public market fit that has maybe a lower underwriting hurdle to it, I guess one of the things that's scares me or gives me pause was the substantial decline in the number of M&A transactions.
Yeah.
We broke a 8 or 9 year, I think 9 year kind of run up to a total of 1,521 transactions in 2018, M&A transactions.
Of previously venture-backed companies.
Right, important right. Previously venture backed companies, of course. That number dropped dramatically to only 1,453 in 2019, losing back to a number lower than 2016. So yeah. We kind of gave back several years of gains in the number of kind of trended number of venture backed startup exits through M&A.
Yeah, and I mean,
what do you think that means?
What do I think that means? So a couple of things. So first off, one really important caveat about this data in particular is that at least in Crunchbase's data set, there's like many, 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 many thousands of transactions listed for any, for any given year. But there's and no doubt many of those companies, have previously raised venture backing, but that venture backing was not included in Crunchbase's data for whatever reason. So it's likely, in fact, it's not just likely, it's almost a virtual guarantee that the real world numbers are somewhat larger than what got reported here. It's just really difficult to know how much, but this is a general trend that we've observed really since I started writing these, since like Crunchbase News started. And since I started writing these quarterly and annual reports, has been a relatively tepid, market when it comes to these acquisitions of venture backed companies, right? There's been a general, I don't really care about the dollar volume because like that is so variable based on any given, really jimungous deal that could get struck. Like, a $5 billion exit could account for, 10% of the dollar volume in any given, quarter, when you're looking at M&A transactions. But like it's the deal volume that I sort of pay most attention to. And assuming that the data that we report is reflective of the real world, which is hopefully not a giant assumption to make, but assuming that it is a reflection of the real world, this does not necessarily bode well for either founders or investors, unless there's also simultaneously been a massive upswing in alternate paths to liquidity at the same time, right? So I know, based on being like a person in the world, that there's been a number of these secondary market, type things that have emerged, fairly recently, or really over the last, 5 years or so. I'm not going to name any specific ones because I don't want to promote anyone over the other, but it's these like marketplaces where you're able to buy these other shares. Shares in like privately held companies and yada yada, like unless there's been a tremendous amount of activity at that stage in that market, which is very opaque and does not often get surfaced in private market data sets from any provider, Crunchbase included. I think that this is a scary thing because it shows that your equity might not get that sort of immediate, that immediate sort of liquidity that an M&A transaction affords, right? And over time, that might mean that founders and investors will need to negotiate, alternate paths to getting that liquidity in order to just make that venture capital model of taking money from, limited partners, investing it, growing it, getting money back and distributing it back to limited partners and taking a fee on this, on the assets themselves and on the gains. Like, in order for that to work out, you need to realize some capital gains. And unless unless there's another path to liquidating a transaction or generating income from, in a dividend stream, for example, from a position or whatever, like being able to get money out and realize those gains is going to be a real challenge.
I don't know if there's a, you know, kind of any way that this is tracked, and we've mentioned it just very tangentially before on the show. But, you know, I mean, as I've reviewed some additional fund documents, you know, more recently, I am seeing some of the fund life, you know, maximum life limits increasing. And because I think venture funds are realizing that it takes them longer. I think the exit environment is taking longer these days. You know, I guess another point that might be interesting to track over a period of time would be of those, you know, of those 1,453 venture-backed startups that reported M&A activity leading to an exit for them this year, I wonder what their you know, how long they had been in business. And obviously the answer to that, there's 1,453 answers to that, but I wonder what the average and median kind of founding timeframes were of those transactions that happened.
Yeah, that would be fascinating again, to look at.
How that data trends over time.
Yeah, I don't know. It'll be interesting.
And I guess I also wonder, you know, and maybe this is a sign of, unfortunately, possibly bad things to come. But maybe this is a sign of things to come. I wonder what that decrease, you know, of the number of M&A transactions, you know, means. I wonder if that's any kind of forewarning of other things of the larger economy. I mean,
it's certainly correlated with like, you know, decrease in business spending. Right.
Sure. I mean, 1,500 is a big number, but still not an absolutely huge number that it couldn't be somewhat coincidental. But that's probably a large enough data set that a decrease from 1,520 to 1,450 is not completely coincidental. Right. So, yeah, I mean, I guess I hope that that's not in any way driven by other economic factors. But I would guess that it is.
Yeah. So, yeah, I don't know. It's going to be weird. I don't know. Yeah. I mean, this is one of those unknown things. And I mean, it's, I don't want to end this on a bad note, man, but like it's probably, I mean, unless something really turns around, right. Or this data is somehow very materially wrong and has been very materially wrong for, you know, for at this point years, which if in my, for the record opinion is very unlikely, this is going to be a massive challenge that founders and investors are going to have to deal with going forward is getting that exit. And if getting that exit is not possible under the current market conditions and people still want to invest in startups, then alternate methods and models of investing in startups will need to emerge. And that might be a topic for a follow-up.
Well, hopefully not to end on a darker note, but any final thoughts or conclusions from your end, Jason?
No, I mean, like in general, I guess my last thought is like in general, like things seem to be going, you know, okay, you know, in most parts of venture land. Definitely stuff to worry about and think about is the, at least as we record today, somewhat in the middle of January 2020, you know, there's been a lot of stories recently about relatively large swaths of layoffs at various very well-funded startups. Those are probably going to accelerate, and there will probably be more companies that get sucked into that going forward. But in general, like I think that there's a lot of other good stuff to, you know, to look at here, and a lot of like, you know, reason for excitement and all the rest, especially if you're, you know, a more early stage focused person, whether you're a founder, investor, or employee listening to this, just because, you know, at least in theory, there's a whole lot of seed stage companies that are going to be coming down your pipeline, you know, at some point in the near future, hopefully. So yeah, I mean, super duper late stage people. Yeah, it seems a little rough. seed stage and early stage still seems pretty exciting.
Well, that's probably a good way to end it. I mean, sure. I guess I could say from the investor perspective, I think, you know, we're probably still at a point both because of our team staffing and fund size and everything, you know, we're probably raising not raising more capital. We're reviewing more startup pitches every year than we ever have. So that, you know, I would say that we're probably being even more selective than we've ever been as a firm too. But we're reviewing more pitches every year. So we're seeing more and more stuff and think overall that, you know, deal flow quality is quite high these days. So I guess there's that, which I also find as good news if you're out there in the fund world. If that's not true for your fund, then give me a call, I guess.
Gotta go get better deal flow.
Exactly.
All right, man. Well, I will we'll chat soon. I'm gonna knock out call recorder.